Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the banana. Americans eat a lot of bananas. They, in fact, eat more bananas than apples and oranges combined. Something else that you probably did not know about the bananas that you buy at the grocery store is that they are all genetically identical. Each one is the same as the one next to it. Now, for producers, that has some advantages. It makes them easy to grow and easy to transport. However, our guest for this hour of Focus, science writer Dan Coppell, he says that also makes bananas susceptible to disease. And in fact, there is a blight that's out there that has the potential to wipe out an entire crop. And that's just what's happening to our supermarket banana, the Cavendish, just one variety in all of those supermarkets. It is rapidly falling victim to disease, and at the moment, there is no cure in sight. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk with Dan Coppell about his book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. It's a very interesting book, and I'm sure that you can find it in the library or the bookstore. The Hudson Street Press is the publisher. And as we talk this morning, questions and comments are certainly welcome. Our guest has been a writer and journalist for more than 20 years, writing about things like nature and sports and technology. He's contributing editor at National Geographic Adventure, and his writing has been featured in other places, including Popular Science, Bicycling, Backpacker, and Popular Mechanics. And he's joining us telephone this morning. So again, questions are welcome. As always, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments so we can keep moving along, get in as many people as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana where the signal travels. So if you're listening over the air, use that number, and that is 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, whichever number works best for you, you just pick up the telephone and give us a call. Mr. Coppell, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I think that one of the things that surprised me a bit, and I expect probably would surprise a lot of people, is just how popular the banana is. I guess I would not have any idea that people in the United States would eat more bananas than they would eat apples and oranges.
Yeah, that's right. It is not just the most popular fruit in the United States by far. It is the world's most popular fruit. It is eaten all around the world more than any other fruit. And in fact, it is the world's fourth biggest crop and the world's biggest fruit crop. It is just behind wheat, rice, and potatoes as the world's fourth biggest crop. So all over the world, the banana is number one in terms of fruit.
And the other thing that I mentioned, I think, here is sort of a key point, is the fact that while there exist many varieties of banana, the big commercial banana, the one that I guess pretty much any grocery that you would go into in the United States and probably a lot of other places as well, there is only one variety available. It's this banana called the Cavendish.
That's right. Most people who live in the United States who aren't going to travel to exotic places will only taste this single banana, the Cavendish. But in fact, it's a surprise to find out that there are over 1,000 different types of bananas. You'll go into your supermarket and maybe see 4, 5, 6 kinds of apples, you know, your Golden Delicious, your Granny Smith, your Macintosh, your Fuji, your Gela. But you're only going to find that one Cavendish. But if you go to India, for example, and go to a local market, you might find 20 or 30 different kinds of bananas. And in that country, people eat 600 kinds of bananas. But we only have the Cavendish. It's just that one yellow supermarket banana that we've got.
Mm. And again, we can go back and talk about some of these things in greater depth, but just to go back and hit the sort of the third major point, this banana, this particular banana, and the story played out with the one that had been the dominant variety before, the Gros Michel. But right now, the big question is, will the Cavendish survive?
Yeah, that's right. Because every Cavendish is just like every other one, it's like human identical twins. If you're an identical twin, you have this genetic sameness as your twin, and so you're susceptible to the same disease. And because we only have this Cavendish banana, when a disease hits, it's going to hit every single one the same way. And so there is a disease out there, and it's very virulent. It's incurable. And so you can imagine with such a disease and with a twin, let's say, that is billions and billions of twins, when this disease hits and when it can spread fast as this disease does, you've got a great threat, and that's what's happening now. And the disease is spreading fast, and the Cavendish is really threatened.
Well, is this this particular disease, is any banana susceptible to that, or are particular varieties most susceptible?
Well, the disease is called Panama disease, and it does threaten many of the 1,000 banana varieties. The difference with Cavendish is that the Cavendish is grown worldwide, and so it can spread worldwide. Of those 1,000 banana varieties, of the hundreds of millions of tons of bananas grown worldwide, 50% of them are Cavendish. And so the Cavendish is really the only banana that is grown in every banana-growing region throughout the tropics, all around the equator, on the planet. And so when this disease threatens the Cavendish, it threatens the planet's bananas. Some of those Indian bananas are only grown in one village or one region. Only the Cavendish is grown everywhere. And so with 50% of those world's bananas being Cavendish, you've got a real banana crisis.
And do we have any kind of a treatment for this particular disease?
There is no treatment. Right now, this disease, which is a fungus, and which I must add makes bananas sick, but cannot make people sick. People ask me that. You can't get sick from eating a banana, period. I want to emphasize that. The disease kills the bananas before they ever get harvested. But there is no cure for this fungus. And this fungus is so, so deadly that even a single clump of dirt, a single piece of dirt on a worker's shoe can be enough to infect an entire plantation, and from there it can spread to an entire country's worth of plantations.
We have a caller already here to bring into the conversation. We'll do that. Not make them wait. And they are in Champaign and line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Someone told me that there's a relationship between bananas and pawpaws. Is that true? And if so, what's the relationship?
Well, as far as I know, there's no relationship directly. In some countries where people grow bananas in their yards, for example, in Africa, a banana can be grown in a village. And banana trees are very tall, and so the leaves of the banana trees provide shade. And the shade is useful to protect other smaller crops, including some other tropical fruits. So if you lose a banana tree to disease, you will also lose the important crops that people survive on that grow underneath. So if a pawpaw or some other fruit or vegetable grows underneath, when the banana dies, you also lose that vegetable. But there's
okay.
No biological relationship.
Yeah, one of the questions, and I'll hang up. My grandkids taught me this little trick. If you take a section of banana and put it in your mouth and stick your tongue down in the middle of it, it breaks into exactly three equal pieces. Is that, and I tried it, and it seems to work. Is that a characteristic of all bananas, or what gives?
Well, I've never heard that.
Well, try it.
I know some other crazy banana tricks, like you can shine your shoes with the inside of a banana peel. Listeners can try that as soon as the show ends, and I'll try your banana trick.
The only thing I could think of, a rose, is all roses have five parts, and apples do, and which is a kind of a rose. And if you cut an apple open, you'll find five seed slots there. And those numbers seem to go along with certain species. At any rate, I just think that was interesting. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, let's go on. We'll talk with someone here in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First, in reply to the question about the pawpaw tree, it's about as closely related to banana as an oak tree.
Okay.
I take it that all of the Cavendish bananas are clones, that they're a single cultivar. Are there highly resistant species or varieties to this fungus disease?
There are resistant varieties. The problem is that those varieties do not have the characteristics necessary to make a good commercial banana. They do not ripen at the proper rate, or they do not ship with the proper hardiness. They don't survive the long shipment required, or they don't taste right to make a decent commercial banana. So, yeah, there are some bananas that do resist Panama disease, or they don't resist other banana diseases. Only the Cavendish of all those 1,000 bananas really has the requirements necessary to make it to our supermarkets and to be accepted by consumers. That's the real problem.
Yes, but if there are resistant varieties, and if they can be hybridized with the Cavendish, it would seem you could breed in a resistance.
Well, the problem with banana breeding is that because the Cavendish is a clone, it's completely sterile. It's got no seeds, no pollen. It grows asexually. And so to breed the Cavendish is virtually impossible. There is banana breeding, but because, and in addition, the banana breeding cycle takes up to 5 years. There have been attempts to breed a resistant banana that have gone on for over 50 years. There has been some success in it, but a lot of those successful breeds have come out of the lab and have lost the resistance within 3 or 4 generations. So, yeah, you're right. There are attempts out there. They've gone very slowly, and so far none have been successful enough to make for a commercial banana. But that is where the hope is. And the hope is now moving towards genetic engineering, which shortcuts a lot of that and works directly at the DNA level. So yeah, you're right. That is where the action is in terms of resisting, trying to find resistance to Panama disease. So far, though, nothing has yielded results that'll change the situation in the supermarkets.
So the Cavendish is actually a sterile hybrid.
That's right.
That's really quite interesting.
Yeah, and that's the problem.
And what are the parents like?
Sorry, I missed that question.
What are the parent varieties like?
What are the other varieties like?
No, what are the parent varieties? There have to be parent varieties for the Cavendish.
Well, the Cavendish has been around for thousands of years, so nobody really knows where it came from. It was discovered in China. There are some other bananas that do have seeds, and that they are looking for seeds. Again, the problem is that once you start breeding, interbreeding bananas, you begin to lose the qualities that are necessary for a supermarket banana. So it's quite a complicated problem to get, you know, if you start breeding bananas with seeds, you start yielding bananas with seeds. Then you start to get bananas that people don't want to eat. And that is really the issue with bananas.
What do banana seeds look like? I had never thought about it, but of course the commercial banana has either a very small non-viable seed or no seed at all.
Right. Well, there are wild bananas out there. A banana seed, a wild banana is about the size of a snap pea or maybe a little bigger. Those are almost all seed, and a banana seed can be about the size of a pea or a little bigger. They're very hard. They'll break your teeth. Some semi-commercial varieties will have about one seed in 100,000, and in fact, some of the breeders will go out there with workers and just find literally thousands of bananas and mash them just in search of one or two seeds that they can use for breeding. They'll take months looking for a seed, and those seeds are also about the same size of a pea or so, and they're very hard. And again, this is the real issue. It's an issue of manual labor, just looking in these varieties for a single stray seed. That's why DNA manipulation is really where the action is right now in bananas. But of course, then you've got the issue of people not wanting to eat genetically modified foods. In Europe, it's illegal to even market them. And a lot of people, when they hear that term, genetically modified food, they recoil. And so then you've got that issue. If you did come up with we've heard the term in banana research, Franken-banana. And a lot of people don't want to eat the Franken banana, even if it did resist these diseases that are very virulent. So you've got a complicated problem with trying to cure and save the banana.
Well, of course, it's one thing to take a gene from a Brazil nut and put it in a strawberry. It's quite another thing to transfer a gene from one banana to another.
It is, I come down on the side of that. The opposition to genetic engineering in bananas is mostly superstition or misinformation. But there's people who don't believe that or are willing to adhere to that form of superstition, and it's absolutely necessary. And one of the things I say in my book is that there are people who absolutely rely on bananas for their primary source of nutrition. For example, in Uganda, in some villages, people rely on bananas for 90% of their daily calories. They eat 900 pounds of bananas a year. That's compared to about 25 pounds of bananas per year for the average American. If those people lose their bananas to disease, they starve. And those bananas are equally threatened by disease. So if we block all forms of banana research, or if we reject them because we don't want those kinds of bananas in our supermarkets, then we really reject research for people who genuinely rely on bananas and who will literally lose their lives, if not livelihoods, without them. And so it is important to realize that banana research and needs to expand in all directions in order to save this fruit, which isn't just delicious and fun for our lunchboxes and great for kids and nutritious and a healthy alternative to Snickers bars and fast food burgers, but is really all over the world an important subsistence product for people who must have them to survive.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dan Coppell, and he is a science and technology writer. His work has appeared many places, including Popular Science and Bicycling and Popular Mechanics, also New York Times Magazine, Wired, Outside, and others. His book is this book that we're talking about here this morning that was published right at the end of last year is titled Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Hudson Street Press is the publisher. He has a website, by the way, that has more than you would ever dream of knowing or wanting to know about bananas. And if you put his name into your web browser and it's spelled K-O-E-P-P-E-L, you can find it, and it makes a fascinating reading. And, of course, you can go out and look for the book Banana. And questions are welcome here, too, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here in Rantoul. This is line one. Hello. Is there a caller there, line one? No? Okay. Well, let me go back to a question I was going to ask, and just to follow up on the kind of the conversation that you're having with the last caller. If indeed this particular banana, the Cavendish, doesn't have any seeds, well, so that means you can't take seeds out of the banana and stick them in the ground and grow a banana. How are Cavendish bananas propagated?
Well, they grow basically, I'll simplify it a little bit, but basically through a system of shoots or cuttings. If you go out into a banana plantation, what you'll see is a row of banana trees. And I might point out here that bananas actually do not grow on trees. The banana is actually the world's largest herb. And so those trees you see are actually stalks or stems. There's no bark on them. That's what makes them not a tree. It's the world's largest herb. One of its closest relatives is vanilla. But if you see those, let's call them trees, you see them growing out of the ground, and then about 20 feet away, you'll see another tree. Well, in most cases, those trees are connected underground. And so one will be what you call a mother plant, and another will be a daughter plant. And they'll keep growing and expanding for about 50 to 60 years before they finally die. So a banana is kind of a semi-eternal plant. And when that dies, you'll take a cutting from it and replant it. So bananas have this sort of infinite life, which is why they're so important in villages in Africa and around the world. One family can take a banana plant, and it can grow pretty much forever. So it's similar to taking a cutting and continuing to grow it. It's really an ideal food for a small family or a small village that needs to grow something without worrying about replanting year after year. And that's what makes it such an excellent commercial crop as well. It's quite easy once you plant a bunch of bananas to turn that into a plantation very quickly without a lot of work, except for the fact that you then have to fight disease.
Mm-hmm. It's in one sense remarkable that the banana has become so common here in the United States and other places around the world, and so inexpensive. When you think about it, for example, particularly here for us in this country, when you think about the fact that this is a kind of exotic tropical fruit, it comes from a long way away, so it has to be shipped a long way. It has a limited shelf life, certainly compared to something like an apple, for example, that such an exotic should be so common in our supermarket today and so cheap. And this is perhaps a long story in and of itself, but how is it that the banana was established as a viable and affordable commodity?
Right. I mean, it's something especially your listeners probably have never thought about too much, but, you know, you're in the heart of apple-growing country mm-hmm. out there, and yet, you know, with apples probably growing within 50 miles of some of where your listeners live, they can often cost twice as much as bananas, which are grown 2,000 miles from their homes. Bananas are shipped under refrigeration, and this has been the case for over 100 years. Now, 100 years ago, most Americans had never even heard of a banana. And in order to make bananas so cheap, entrepreneurs basically discovered this fruit, built demand for it, and they had to make it cheap by doing some pretty terrible things. And it's a very sad and tragic and ugly story. They had to control everything, you know, to make this banana, which had to be shipped under refrigeration, which only, as you said, you know, spoiled after 2 weeks, and had to be transported all this distance cheap. They really had to get land for nothing, and they had to get labor for nothing. And so in order to grow bananas in Central America for these prices, they pretty much had to take over countries, and they had to enslave people. Banana workers were terribly treated, and countries were overrun by, let's say, banana company-led armies, often the U.S. Army. Between 1900 and 1960, there were over 20 interventions, many of them led directly by the U.S. government at the behest of banana companies, to make sure that any country that didn't favor the banana company policies was pretty much put down. And there was a term for this that emerged. Central American countries that were controlled by banana companies were known as banana republics. And there were some bloody massacres. There was overthrows of democracies. And the effects of these overthrows are still being felt today in terms of instability of governments and mistreatment of banana workers. So to keep bananas cheap, labor and land had to be controlled. And it is a very sad history, and you know, bananas are still cheap today, and that's because, to a great extent, banana workers are still underpaid, and it still remains a very sort of, you know, schizophrenic product. It's a wonderful product; we love it. It's benign; it's great for kids, but there's still a lot of controversy and sadness and some unfairness in the banana industry. In our southern neighbors.
Yeah, that makes a fascinating example of the way that a commodity can become tangled up with the politics of nations and have a huge impact on how at least people who are in the producing countries live their lives.
Yeah, that's right. As I said, you know, Ecuador is now the world's largest banana-producing country, and I don't think it's a coincidence that of all the countries that produce bananas in Latin America, Ecuador has the weakest child labor laws, for example, and you know, that's something that is not lost on the big banana companies that bring bananas to our markets today.
Well, we mentioned, or maybe I mentioned in passing, the fact that we have today this one dominant variety, the Cavendish. That's the one you go into your here in Champaign-Urbana. You go into the grocery store, you buy a banana, that's what it is you're going to get. Previously, it was a similar situation, but there was a different variety. There was one dominant variety, the Gros Michel. And this, and you can tell the story, but apparently what happened here is that this banana succumbed to this disease that we're now concerned with affecting the Cavendish. What's the story of the Gros Michel?
Right. Well, I always tell people, and this is the biggest surprise that I talk about in my book, and you know, the catch line is always interesting to people. I say the banana you eat today is not the one your grandparents were raised on. That banana was not the Cavendish, as you say. It was called the Gros Michel or Big Mike banana. That was the one that was introduced by the banana barons about 120 years ago to Americans who didn't know about the banana. And the really fascinating thing about the Gros Michel is that it was a bigger, tougher, it shipped better, it ripened slower, and better tasting banana than the Cavendish that we eat today. There was one problem with the Gros Michel. Almost immediately after it was introduced, this strange disease started to wipe it out. And it took about 10 to 15 years to identify it, but it was a fungus. The disease was first seen in Panama, and so it was named Panama disease. And every place it struck, it wiped out plantations. And so the banana companies were literally chased across Latin America by this disease. Every time a plantation would be ruined, they would cut down some rainforest and open a new plantation. And by about 1960, they were out of places to grow bananas. And they had to find a replacement banana, and the candidate was this Cavendish banana. And believe it or not, executives, especially at Chiquita, thought that the Cavendish was a terrible banana. They described it as a junk banana. They thought it was so bad-tasting and so poor in quality that they resisted it. They felt that it couldn't ship properly. They had to bag it and box it, unlike the Gros Michel, which was tough enough, didn't bruise, that they could just throw those bananas by the bunch into the cargo hold of a ship. And until the very end, Chiquita sort of was stuck in its mindset and did not want to adopt this banana. And the Chiquita, which was the world's largest, most profitable banana company, in fact, the company that invented the banana market, has existed since the day the banana was introduced to the United States and introduced the banana, was on the verge of bankruptcy in 1960 when at the last minute it finally introduced the Cavendish with much hand-wringing. And basically the Cavendish resisted Panama disease. That was the only reason they introduced it. Well, fast forward another 40 years to about 2000, and all of a sudden a new version of Panama disease emerges. And this Panama disease, which is called race 4 of Panama disease, well, this one can affect the Cavendish. And now the problem is there's not even a junk banana, a lesser banana, that is available to replace the Cavendish. But, yeah, that Gros Michel banana that was considered to be a more delicious, better banana, but it was wiped out by the same disease that now threatens the Cavendish today. Hey.
It's really interesting to think about. I guess I would say that the bananas that we have now, the Cavendish, seems to me they're pretty good. But if that's all the only banana that you have ever had, you don't have anything to compare it with. It's kind of hard to imagine what a better banana would taste like.
Well, you know, if any of your listeners have traveled to places like the Philippines or India or, you know, even Hawaii, for example, where some bananas of a breed called Fei bananas are grown, they're purplish. They've probably tasted better bananas. A better banana, kind of, I can give you a profile, will have a creamier taste, a more intense banana flavor, perhaps a different texture. In Brazil, they prefer a more tart banana, which has a almost apple-y flavor. So most banana experts or people from other countries who, I live in Los Angeles, and we have a lot of Filipino immigrants, and they describe our bananas as tasteless. They like a banana that has some kind of other taste characteristic. So, you know, I sort of call our banana the McDonald's hamburger of bananas. It's very ubiquitous. It's very cheap. It's friendly. There's nothing really wrong with it, so to speak. It's a lot healthier than a McDonald's hamburger. But it's not a gourmet banana. I'm not trying to put down the Cavendish. I eat a lot of them, and I love them, and it's not a bad banana by any means, but there's a world of bananas out there, and I encourage anyone who travels to places, you know, in India, if you ever go there, they'll give Americans Cavendish bananas because they think that's what we love, and you probably won't get exotic ones or local ones unless you ask for them, but they are better, and they have just a more intense interesting flavor, and they're worth seeking out if you can find them, if you go to the places where they're available. Hmm.
Again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Dan Coppell, and if you go looking for his book, his last name is spelled K-O-E-P-P-E-L. And the book that we're talking about is Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, was published just at the end of last year. Hudson Street is the publisher. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore or the library. Our guest has been a journalist for more than 20 years, writing about nature, sports, the outdoors, and technology. His work has appeared in a number of places. He's contributing editor at National Geographic Adventure, has been featured in Popular Science, Bicycling, Popular Mechanics. He's also written for the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Outside, and others, and he's talking with us this morning by phone. As we continue to talk, your questions are welcome, 333-9455, and a toll-free 800-222-9455. Another interesting chapter here is has to do with how it is that the banana industry promoted the product, because as you said, there would have been a time when there were a lot of people that they'd never seen a banana before. They wouldn't know what to do with it. I seem to recall hearing a story about somebody. The story, I have sort of a vague hold on it, but the thing that I remember about the story was that it was someone who was a European, and it was an immigrant to the United States, a woman who had come to this country from Europe, had just landed here in the United States, and was in Ellis Island, and someone gave her a banana. And she'd never seen one before. She had no idea what it was, and she didn't know how to eat it. So she ate it whole. She didn't even know that the idea was that you peeled it, and the fruit part, the part that you ate, was inside. So for a lot of people, they at least early on here, they would have had to have been introduced to the notion of what this thing is and what to do with it.
Yeah, that's right. Banana education was a huge part of the banana industry, and Chiquita early on set up a education department that began right from the start. One of the first things they had to do was convince women that it was acceptable to eat a banana because of the shape of the banana. And this sounds silly and a little bit naughty, but it really was a problem for women to hold something shaped like a banana. And so what Chiquita did was released pictures of very proper Victorian women. They printed thousands of postcards. This was around 1890. These were postcards of women at picnics, and they were very good, respectable women holding bananas at picnics. This was what made it okay to have a banana. And this sort of introduced the banana as something women could serve their families. Later on, Chiquita hired doctors to let people know that bananas were something children could eat for breakfast. Again, nobody knew who could eat a banana or why. Even into the 1940s and 50s, when Chiquita came up with the famous Chiquita Banana song, the lyrics of that song constantly changed to include sort of mini versions of banana recipes. There was always an effort to keep people buying bananas and tell them ways to eat them. It was a fruit industry, and that hadn't happened ever before. The apple and orange people were stunned that a brand name was applied to a fruit, and that an industry could rise around something that grew on a tree. It wasn't like a candy bar or a packaged cereal where there was a brand name on it. I mean, the idea that you would put a sticker on a fruit and market it as a brand name was something completely alien, and then that you would teach people how to eat it was just brilliant marketing, a brilliant idea on the part of those early banana people, and it was necessary to make Americans love this fruit, and they succeeded.
All right. We have a number of other callers. In fact, several of them here ready to go, all lined up, and we'll get right to them and start here with Urbana and line one.
Yeah, is that for me?
Yes.
Oh, hi. I was in Vietnam. I don't know if you talked about this. I went to Vietnam, and we had those little bananas, the ones that came in bunches, and we all devoured them. And I don't know if you talked about them, but here in Urbana or Champaign, on 5th Street, I guess it's Champaign, there's a store called the Far East. It's a Vietnamese grocery, and they have them there. They're just delightful to eat. They're not too much, not too big, and get full. But did you talk about those?
Yeah, those little bananas, which Chiquita does market as baby bananas, they are a form of Cavendish, actually. For the most part, you'll find them in the U.S. as a form of Cavendish. They do taste better. They're genetically the same, but they're bred to be smaller. And because they're smaller, they're a little sweeter. There are amazing bananas in Vietnam. One is called the La Ba, which is an absolutely delicious banana. And I do love the baby bananas because they are smaller. They do have a higher sugar content, and they have a nicer texture. So if you do find the baby bananas out there, they're available in some supermarkets as well, depending on where you are in the U.S.
Yeah, it really has a wonderful taste, and aesthetically, they're a pleasure to look at.
Yeah, and they're not too big either, so they have fewer calories. Sometimes
well, that's what I said. I like them because I don't start eating extra ones. Well, that's good. Thank you.
All right. To another caller, this is Savoy, line two. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Yeah.
I'm from India, actually. I grew up in India, so I had eaten quite a few varieties of bananas, and the biggest observation that I have is that, you know, since I've been living in the U.S., it seems like the bananas are getting bigger and bigger every year. And then we have a nickname for the Cavendish at home. We call them Barry Bonds Banana because they keep getting bigger. But also, there is a grocery store in Champaign, and there's a grocery store in a Filipino grocery store in Springfield, and one Indian grocery store in Champaign, and they both have the smaller, sweeter, much better-tasting bananas.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I thank you for the call. Is it true, Dan, that that the your average size of the banana is getting bigger?
I'm not too aware of that. The size does vary depending on where the bananas come from. So, and that's determined by which company delivers them. Organic bananas tend to be a little bigger, but it's not consistent. You may be getting bigger ones over there, but I'm not going to say that your caller is wrong. But for example, in Los Angeles, we get bigger ones sometimes and smaller ones. It may be seasonal. It may also have to do with what's happening down in South America. Right now, there's some problems in Ecuador with the supply chain, and so the bananas there are smaller because of weather. But I haven't noticed that.
Okay. Well, I guess my experience as someone who eats a lot of bananas and the regular grocery store variety, I guess my experience is that there can be a big difference. Sometimes they're really big, and sometimes they're relatively small. And it's just what's there. You know, I guess I don't think very much about it. It's there. That's what's there. I buy them.
Yeah. What happens is if it's looking like the weather's going to be bad, they'll cut them off the tree, earlier and. That means they're smaller. The idea is to keep them on the tree as long as possible. Once bananas are green until they will not ripen until they get cut. So you want to keep them on the tree as long as possible. Once you cut them, they start to turn yellow, and you've got about 10 days to 2 weeks before they go brown. So they got to get into the shipping chain right away. So the goal of a banana plantation owner is to keep it on the tree as long as possible. That gets you a bigger banana.
Mm. Given the fact that, you know, we know now that we have a globalized food system and that we have food traveling all over the world, and I don't know, for example, here in Champaign-Urbana, I have no idea what's the furthest away food that you can find in the store, but is it possible that that someone, say, a producer, not in Latin America but somewhere else, India, Asia, the Philippines, somewhere else, could realize that there would be a market in the United States, and particularly if the Cavendish goes away, that are there people thinking about the fact that, yes, it would be possible to grow bananas, some of those places, and ship them and sell them in the United States?
Right now, there is no real effort to bring an alternate banana to the United States, either from Latin America or the Philippines or anywhere else. Those bananas that grow in India or the Philippines or Africa, those non-Cavendish, they could be grown in Latin America or in the Caribbean, for example. Just about anywhere bananas are grown, you can move a banana and plant it somewhere else. The issue is really the supply chain again. How do you keep those bananas from ripening? How do you get them to the supermarket? The banana supply chain right now is fine-tuned for Cavendish. You would have to retune it. And there's been some talk of doing that very recently, but it's talk from from entrepreneurs. And the question is, how do you make that cost effective? I think at some point, Chiquita and Dole, the two big banana companies, are going to have to start looking at it. The Philippine government has started getting interested in that and may subsidize some of that. But we're talking something that right now is probably 5 to 10 years away, and I'd say that is about the same time frame in which this disease, Panama disease, which has yet to hit Latin America, it's ravaging Asia right now, is going to arrive in Latin America. So you're literally in a race against time for both those things to happen.
Mm-hmm. And there, just to make sure that we're clear on this, the Panama disease can and does attack other varieties other than the Cavendish, but are there some varieties that are resistant?
Yeah, there are definitely some varieties that are resistant. There are about 12 other significant banana diseases, and there are various degrees of resistance in all of them. There are also various ways to control them, ranging from proper management, quarantine, to uses of chemicals, some of which are very harsh. So there are, you know, let's say cocktails of management methods. But yeah, Panama disease is not exclusive to the Cavendish. It did hit the Gros Michel, and there are many of those other banana varieties that are susceptible. The key is diversity. You want to have more than one banana, just like you have more than one apple and more than one orange, so that when something hits, you're going to not have all your, you know, bananas in one basket.
Yeah.
If you are growing six different kinds of bananas, if consumers can find six or seven or five or how many kinds of bananas in their market, then seasonal fluctuations because of disease or weather or whatever are not going to be as serious. And we consumers should expect that and demand it, just like we expect it and find it very natural in the world of apples and fruits and lettuce and all kinds of other things in our produce aisle. It's a little silly to think that there's only one kind of banana. If you look at the produce aisle, there's all kinds of things out there that there's multiple varieties. And that's the real answer. It's not that bananas are so weak. It's that bananas are weak because there's only one kind of banana. So the real answer for the future isn't just making the Cavendish stronger, as we discussed with that earlier caller, through genetic engineering and better breeding. It's also finding more than one banana out there so that the effect of whatever hits it will be diluted and that we have more choices when bad things happen.
About 5 minutes left. Our guest is Dan Coppell. His book is Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. We'll go next and talk with someone in Bourbonnais, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Up here, we can now get in our mainstream supermarkets organic bananas and also plantains. Is there any hope for the future in either of those? Are they both Cavendish, and does either thing offer any options that regular conventionally grown bananas don't?
Okay, so a lot of people ask me, you know, what's the difference between bananas and plantains? In the banana world, we call plantains cooking bananas and Cavendish and sweet bananas, dessert bananas. They're different breeds, a little bit genetically different, but fundamentally, they share the same weaknesses. Plantains are not Cavendish, but they are susceptible to similar diseases. They may hold some genetic properties, but obviously, a plantain which is not edible off, straight ahead, like, you know, you can't slice a plantain into your cornflakes. Organic bananas are Cavendish bananas, and so they are not going to be terribly helpful. In fact, because they're organic, they're not going to have a great usefulness because you can't spray them with any chemicals. Not that I advocate that, but they really are going to resist disease less well than any conventionally grown banana. But I recommend that we eat organic bananas if you can afford them, because they're much safer for banana workers who are not sprayed with chemicals and the pesticides that are required to grow conventional bananas in order to keep them from acquiring the current crop of diseases that affect bananas right now.
Okay. Well, that's what I wanted to know.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll go on here. I have another caller. This is someone in Pasodum on line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Interesting show. I got a little different slant or a story anyway on your bananas in Ecuador. During the 70s when I was down there, we had a Peace Corps project where we fed bananas to hogs as replacing corn. The corn wouldn't grow very well. And got started because a friend of mine who I made raised bananas for Chiquita. And they would throw a lot of the bananas away that didn't quite meet quality. And then he, looking for a use for those, bought a bunch of pigs and started feeding them to him. So our project was to come up with a balanced diet to go with the bananas, because they'd eat 20 pounds a day, but they needed a protein to go with them, because bananas are mostly 80% water. And turned out to be one of the more successful programs in that area, because smaller farmers could adapt very well to this. They got to where they would go ahead and plant bananas and then just run and let the animals run through the banana fields, and then every once in a while they'd go through and with machete and just cut down a tree and then let the pigs come and eat it as it lay right there on the ground, and then supplement that up near the house with the protein and the minerals that they needed. So it turned out to be a very economic, very successful program. So Ecuador now, you mentioned something about Ecuador still growing bananas. I was just down there last summer. Didn't get a chance to get back out to where I was, but there's a lot of African palm down there, although banana is making a comeback. And I don't know, you're talking about the Chiquita mostly, but the Gros Michel was still grown down there when I was there. In fact, my friend said the Chiquitas are for the pigs, the Gros Michel, that's human food there. So just a story.
Okay, well, I appreciate the story. I don't know, Dan, you react to that at all?
Well, Ecuador is, just to comment, Ecuador is the world's largest banana exporting country right now, and it is the world's third largest banana growing country after India and Brazil. So it is definitely in the banana game.
Mm-hmm. We're down to the point here. We have just a couple of minutes left. Going back to the point that you made, I think, before we took this last caller, and that is the hazards associated with limiting yourself to a particular cultivar of anything. That what happens is then you make yourself reliant on just one variety, and then there's the possibility that if something comes along, some disease or some problem comes along and attacks that crop, then you're out of business because you have no other varieties to turn to. And that's why it is that one of the reasons that some people think that it's really important to preserve various kinds of heirloom varieties and have as much diversity as possible. It seems to me that we should have learned this lesson before. But somehow we don't. We have continued to limit the commercial varieties of all kinds of things that are available. Not that there aren't other varieties, but that maybe it's not quite as dramatic as the case with the banana, where there's only one. But in so many of the things that we eat, there certainly are a lot of other varieties that are generally not grown and eaten.
Yeah. I mean, with bananas, there's something, I would say, psychological about it. We see bananas and we see them as cheap. The whole mindset of the banana industry and the banana consumer, including me, is that bananas have to be cheap. 59 cents a pound, 49 cents a pound, 69 cents a pound. It's incredibly inexpensive. And at that price, you can't really have more than one banana in conventional wisdom. You have to go with the monoculture. Like I said, it's just like the McDonald's burger. You can't do it any way but the least common denominator, and Cavendish is that least common denominator banana. It's not like the heirloom tomatoes and the heirloom apples, where prices can range from 79 cents a pound to $2.99 a pound, at the fancy gourmet markets for different kinds. The banana companies have been very hesitant to experiment with bananas across a range of prices. One reason is that they go bad quickly and they don't want to lose money on expensive bananas. But another reason, I think, is that they detect a consumer resistance that we might not even see a banana that costs $1.75 a pound as a banana. We might not be willing to take the risk to eat it. We see the banana as something so almost the right to a cheap banana, as the cheapest fruit, as the most available fruit, as the one we carry around with us in our lunch boxes. It's you know, the New York Times, even as early as 1910, there was a move to tax bananas, and they objected to this in an editorial. It was like taxing air. The banana was the fruit of the masses, and it still is. And so, you know, this is the monoculture, the single crop of the banana is connected to our sort of like love of this as the one thing that is available to everyone, the one healthy, delicious thing in the supermarket that's nutritious and great and cheap. And so I think that's the hurdle we have to get over, that there needs to be a bunch of kinds of bananas and up and down a price range. And believe it or not, if we had a bunch of other kinds of bananas, it wouldn't be out of the range of any ordinary consumer, you know, maybe 10, 15 cents a pound more for most of them. So I'm not saying get ready for $2.99 a pound bananas. I'm saying, you know, a variety that most of them would be quite affordable. So it's more of a sort of mindset thing than an actual economic thing.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. If you want to read more on the subject, the book to look for is Banana, the Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. It was just published at the end of last year. It's published by Hudson Street Press by our guest, Dan Coppell. And again, if you look for his book, his name is spelled K-O-E-P-P-E-L. He's a science, nature, technology writer, contributing editor at National Geographic Adventure. It's written for a lot of other publications. And again, has a really interesting website with everything you'd ever wanted to know about bananas there. Just put his name into your browser, and I'm sure that you will find it. Or look for the book. Put the title of the book in, and you will do the same. And Dan, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.